This is part three of the talk by Roland Klette entitled God is All. It is being read by Anthony Whitehouse. Subheading: Omniscient God. Without God being and including all science, there would be no Christian science, and creation would be chaotic if it existed at all. God must include all science and be wholly scientific. If, when giving a treatment, we were always scientific, we would never miss out on a healing. In treatment, it isn't scientific to declare God to be all there is, and then to believe for a single moment that we have a patient to heal, or even to believe that we have a disease to cope with or to get rid of, or that there is a situation over which we have to make a demonstration. If God is all, then he is all, and none of these things can stand in the presence of the Lord. In fact, there isn't anything unlike God that can stand in the presence of God. If you are giving a treatment or trying to realize the allness of God, do consider the fact that while you believe yourself to be a mortal sitting and endeavoring to realize God's allness and omnipresence, then you are not really accomplishing very much. If God is all, then God is all, and there certainly cannot be scientifically God and a mortal trying to realize his allness. Do let your reasoning be wholly scientific. If God is, and he certainly is, then there cannot be God and you, or any mortal trying to realize God's allness. Scientific reasoning will tell you clearly that there is only God, and God only, declaring himself, declaring his omnipresence, declaring his omnipotence, declaring his omniscience, and declaring his omni-action. Reasoning is another word for treatment, but reasoning is not reasoning at all unless it is scientific. Unscientific treatment is not Christian science. Scientific treatment starts with the fact that there is nothing but God. The allness of God abides steadfastly in it and never leaves it. Some words about the authenticity of the Bible from the simple fellow's point of view would not be out of place under the heading of truth. Every now and again I come across someone who has doubts about the verity of the Bible. Are the stories true? Do these things, such as Adam and Eve, Noah and the Ark, really happen? And if they didn't actually happen, don't the Bible lessons and what they teach fall flat? Well, for myself, I have never really given serious consideration as to whether these stories might be true or not. Anybody giving time to the careful study of the Bible cannot fail to detect the thread of obvious sincerity running right through from beginning to end. The people who were responsible for this remarkable book did not go to all this trouble as a hoax. It is not as if they said, "Well, we will try to make people happy for a time at least, even if there is no truth in it." That all these documents have been preserved for thousands of years and were in the end brought together through a remarkable set of circumstances to be consolidated into a book that has been and is the world's bestseller is in itself something so extraordinary that one cannot fail to see the hand of God involved. I would say that the destruction of the Bible would be an impossibility, and those who have sought to change the original version to suit their own ends and to conceal the truth are in a state of confusion today. The old-time writers were impelled to write as they did because they actually saw with spiritual insight what they wrote. Otherwise, such things as have been written could never have been revealed. Such statements as this one made by the preacher in Ecclesiastes, "Vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun?" Ecclesiastes actually saw the unreality of all material things a long time ago, things that were real to many and still are, but which a few today are beginning to see in their true light. The preacher had wonderful insight and vision. The meaning of vanity is empty idleness, uselessness, futile, devoid of worth. Mrs. Eddy actually saw the unreality of matter, its utter non-existence, its emptiness, its futility. Who could have done this but Mrs. Eddy? Must we look to the physical scientists for confirmation of our faith, or are we like Thomas, to whom Jesus said, "Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed." Who will accept Mrs. Eddy's statement regarding matter without fully understanding it? Another profound statement and command, which is full of meaning and points to the sincerity of the writer, was made by Isaiah when he said, "Cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of?" This statement was clearly made by a spiritual seer who could clearly see beyond the evidence of his five senses. He could see that there could be no origin for that vanity of vanities, a matter man, that fake which deceiveth the whole world. This doubt as to the authenticity of the Bible brings to mind a controversy which raged many years ago in the columns of the Sunday Times as to whether Jesus was really the son of the Virgin. This controversy went on for some time. I eventually became so incensed at the stupidity of the argument that I wrote a letter which was published demanding to know what difference it made as to whether Jesus was or was not the son of a virgin, so long as we all followed his example and obeyed his commandments, which apparently was not what many people considered to be the really important factor. No more letters appeared on the subject after that. What difference does it make who wrote the Bible? It was written, was it not? And if we do what it says, it proves its own authenticity. I believe that God was its author through inspiration. The whole of material existence is a dream, whichever way you look at it. While on the subject of the Bible, I would like to talk about the serpent, that is, Moses' serpent, or the handling of animal magnetism. The rod which Moses had in his hand was a false belief of doubt and fear on which he was leaning. He thought the Israelites would not believe that God had sent him, and was afraid that they would reject his mission. Then God, wisdom, told him to cast the rod of doubt and fear away. He did so, and saw that he had been holding on to a serpent, a false belief, or animal magnetism, all the time. He naturally ran away from it. He shrank from it mentally. But having seen error for what it was, wisdom bade him come back and handle it, see its nothingness, deny its reality, which he did. Then this experience became a real staff upon which to lean. Subheading, God as Love. One of the first questions I asked when I first became acquainted with Christian Science was, "What does perfect love casteth out fear mean?" I was supposed to be fearful and nervous, and I felt that if this perfect love could cast out fear, then I wanted to know all about it. But I'm sorry to say that my question remained unanswered, or I didn't understand the answer, for I was to go through many years of fear-filled misery before I even began to get an idea of the meaning of perfect love. One day I asked an experienced Christian scientist, "How do we know that God is love?" After a few moments of thought, she said, "Well, God does not go around breaking himself off into pieces, does he?" I thought this over, but it did not mean much to me until I began to realize that I am God's self. God being all, whatever activity takes place in the divine mind must be me. What else could I be? What else could you be? All God has to think about is himself. What else is there for him to think about? So I have to be God's loved self, God's beloved son. Think of it. God contemplating his own ineffable purity and goodness and loving what he sees. Could he dislike what he sees? Could there be any element of hate or sadism here? No, of course not. If God did this, he would be disliking himself, hating himself, even punishing himself, and making himself miserable for something he had done. This is too fantastic to contemplate, is it not? Yet some do believe it. Do you? God loves everything he sees because he is all in all. And this actual activity of love, loving, is you and me and all of us. Is it conceivably possible for this activity of love to be separated from love? Can there be a dividing line between love loving itself? No, God loves us all with an everlasting love. Now rest in this absolute assurance. Subheading: The Effect of Love. Man is God individualized. A Christian scientist once put it this way: God reveals himself as man. If God is all there is, then of course none of us would deny that all we can see is God. It isn't God and lots and little bits of God. It is all God himself, for there is nothing else. What we see as people must, in view of this, be translated somehow into God, so that in the light of God's allness, we can know that what appears to us as people can be seen as God individualized, but still God. If man, you and I and all of us, is not God individualized, then man has no real entity, for God is the life of man. If the man or woman you are looking at, by look I mean seeing mentally, does not seem to you at all the likeness of God, then it is because you are looking through the distorted lens of mortal thinking. But it is still God, no matter how it appears to you. I once healed instantaneously an alcoholic who had reached the end of the road and was due to be fired from his job after many years of service. He had already been thrown out of his church. And yet I caught a glimpse of him as God expressed, and felt a great compassion for him, and he never had another drink, although he never took to Christian Science. This feeling of compassion, of which we catch fleeting glances, must be the love Mrs. Eddy spoke about when she said, "Just be love." Mrs. Eddy says in Science and Health, "In patient obedience to a patient God, let us labour to dissolve with the universal solvent of love the adamant of error, self-will, self-justification, and self-love, which wars against spirituality and is the law of sin and death. The word adamant means that which stubbornly resists removal. Some of these stubborn things appear to be resentment, the worst, lust, fear, hate. Anything that is not pure love must be classed as hate. Irritability, impatience, spite, anger. Much of this involves thinking and talking about one's fellow man. To reverse this, let us consider the fact of God's allness, that there isn't God and something else, so that whoever we see is God individualized or God expressed. If we look for God in everyone we see, we will actively be loving. Every one of these people is a child of God. If some of them may not appear so to us because of what seems to us to be false, then we can know that this is only a distorted view of God. But it is still God we are looking at, for there is nothing else to look at. You may be looking at a beautiful bird through a badly focused pair of binoculars. To you, the bird appears ugly and distorted. But is it really that? No, the bird is really beautiful, and you know it is so, in spite of the view through the badly focused glasses. And therefore, you are going to continue focusing your glasses until you see the bird as you know it really is. You know that man is perfect, because God could not make anything imperfect. So continue to correct the focusing of your thought until you see him as you know he really is. This is really putting love into action and getting it to flow. This is turning the switch on. This is loving your fellow man. When we make this inexhaustible supply of love active in our own life, it will meet our needs. This applies to all, even those we don't know. To give a beggar a few cents is easy, but to give him a good treatment by seeing him as God's perfect idea requires an effort which not only will meet his need, but yours as well. Don't let us use the excuse that we may not give a man a treatment without his consent. He is asking us for something. Give him what you have plenty of, love. It is quite impossible for us to love what we believe to be an imperfect model. What I have said here applies to everything, no matter what appears in our experience, be it an accident, an illness, or what have you. It is a distorted view of God. So let us look for God in everything. As God is all there is to look for, we will find him. And when we find him within, the healing takes place without. When we find him within, the healing takes place without. He is all we need, and he is all ours. Subheading: Love Answers Prayer. There was a little boy who got down on his knees and prayed like this: Oh God, please make me a good boy. He was already surprised when God answered and said, But I have already made you a good boy. All you have to do is act that way. I suppose in some way it is really quite remarkable how some of us try desperately to be something we are not. Mostly we try to be as others are, so that we can be in the swim, as it were. You know, everybody does it. Then to satisfy ourselves that we are not really going astray, we humbly pray to God about it. The only prayer that God ever answers is when we set ourselves to find out exactly what we are, and then steadfastly endeavour to act like what we know we are. Then God meets us halfway and gives us a helping hand. People who deliberately act bad are trying desperately to be something which they are not and which they can never be. I would not say that the prayer of supplication is wrong, very far from it. I have been given to understand by some Christian scientists that we don't ask God for anything. We affirm that which we know he has already given us. But my personal experience is different. I certainly believe in petitioning God. Sometimes when situations have appeared to me to be desperate, I have said out loud, mostly in anguish, "O God, please help me." Sometimes I have heard myself say, "God, you have got to help me now, no arguments." And I have even heard myself saying, "God, you are responsible for me, now please get me out of this fix." Well, do you know, I cannot remember a time when God did not render the required assistance. Not always in the way which I might have anticipated, but nevertheless the assistance came. Always there has been a lesson. How does it happen that way? Well, I believe that when we are desperate, we are at a stage where we have tried everything that we can do ourselves without success, and are no longer depending on ourselves. We are humble and willing to lessen, with every false sense of self discarded as being useless. Then we hear God talking. Don't let anybody tell you that the prayer of supplication is not Christian Science. Jesus said, "Ask and ye shall receive." And sometimes it is the easiest thing to do. Possibly the only thing left for you to do. Just ask and expect an answer. Subheading: Fear Masquerading as Love. The carnal mind, pointing to love, says to us, "That is fear." We instantly picture fear in some form or another. It could be an accident, a disease, a fight, and this is all we can see until we stop to think and realize that we have been fooled, that because God is all there is to see, what we really have been looking at is God, seen through the distorted lens of fear, but still it is God. You and I could, of course, have been just an instant in contradicting the suggestions of the carnal mind by declaring the omnipresence of love, which of course is the truth, and the consequent absence of fear. We could have said, "I know it is God, for God is all. So it isn't fear, it must be love." We must not give fear any innings. We must not play ball with the carnal mind. It is up to every dirty trick it can use against us. Could we possibly have said, "I agree, it is fear," when we know that God is all? This does not affirm that fear is love, not at all. It simply means that we refuse to recognize that there is anything called fear. We read in the textbook, "Jesus beheld in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal man appears to mortals." He couldn't see that sinning mortal man because it wasn't there. Nor does it mean that because mortals saw a sinning and sick mortal, they were looking at something different to what Jesus was looking at. They were both looking at the same thing. They were both really looking at God, love. Nobody can see anything but God anywhere, can you? Principle and its idea is one, and that one is God, and God is all. So what can anyone see but God? Do you want to know how to love instead of fear? Don't look for people and things, just look for God. He is there. All sin, sickness, death, and form of error is only fear is in one of its forms, trying to emulate the omnipresence of love. Fear is false evidence appearing real. It is false even before it becomes evidence. I do believe that this is why Mrs. Eddy said in the chapter in Science and Health on Christian Science Practice that we must begin every treatment by allaying the fear of the patient. And she goes on to say that if we can get rid of the fear, the patient is healed, proving that the disease is some form of fear. Further on, she says that if we have done all and the patient is not healed, fear is still governing the case. The meaning of the word fear has become distorted over the ages. To fear God meant to love and respect God, and it still means just that. If you believe that you feel afraid, just know that it is the carnal mind distorting the appearance of love in your experience and calling it fear. People ask me why this or that has happened to them, and I invariably answer them by asking, "What would you do if you fell into a deep hole?" As my question is apparently irrelevant to the problem, I very seldom receive a direct answer. So I ask in turn, "Would you continue sitting on the bottom of the hole, wondering how you came to fall in, and asking why such a thing happened to you?" Obviously, the answer is that you would not waste any time asking why or how. You would use all the energy and ingenuity at your disposal to get out of the hole as quickly as possible. Let us not waste time examining error to find out how it came upon us, or even look for a cause. Error has no cause at all, and we are not suffering it. There is only one thing to do about it: heal it quickly, climb out of the hole as quickly as possible. Now, as I began with the first four words in the Bible, "In the beginning God," so I will end with the last word in the Bible. Amen.